That's a little bear.
Oh, I thought this was a Rorschach.
No, it could be, but it's actually one of three juggling bears. These are quite apt because the remarkable rally that's been going on in the stock market for a number of months now seems to have turned into a little spin today, and the Dow's off about 150 points, the S&P's off 14. So if you're a typical professor my age, you're a little bit older, been in the socking the money away in TIA CREF for the past 20 years, you're stuck about $10,000 for the day. But you know, you still got 20 more years to retirement, and you had to take the pay of them the $10,000 at some point, so no big problem. Now, if you're going to retire tomorrow, you've lost $10,000. But so that's the little bear, or a big bear, or maybe it'll reverse. And by the way, anyone who does wish to purchase stocks and therefore turn this rally, I'm sure we'd all be prepared to excuse you so that you might reverse this event. Okay, the plan is to talk about Talleyrand's isoparametric inequality. Now, this inequality, I'm just going to discuss one inequality, and actually this is a theory. There's a whole catalog of inequalities that are proved with a reasonably unified set of techniques, but with lots of variation in the detail. There's one that seems particularly well tailored to the types of problems that we've investigated, and that's the one naturally that's all focused on the most. I'll make an application of that. I'll first describe Talleyrand's inequality, then I'll make an application of it to the longest increasing subsequence problem, which you remember we made a rather hard attack at using the freeze method, but we'll get a better result reasonably automatically using the Talleyrand's method. Then I give a proof of the isoparametric inequality, and particularly add a picture to the proof that's in the notes that everybody should have. My mastery of XFIG has evolved considerably over the summer, but not in time to get the pictures that I wanted into the manuscript. But there are going to be at least 20 pictures in the real life of a book once it's completed. A little quick comparison to the theory of hereditary sets. I think I'll just refer to what's in the notes on that. The bottom line is that theory of hereditary sets is an area where there's very refined results, and it's interesting to see how Talleyrand gets as close to those results as one could reasonably expect with a fully general theory. Look briefly at the theory of suprema of linear functionals. There are lots of the questions that we've been interested in that can be rephrased rather simply in terms of just the supremum of or class of linear functionals on random variables. And then we'll look at the tail of the assignment problem. And don't have quite as many foils as I'd like. I was too involved with fantasies of fear and greed during a linear hour. Okay. Now that's a bit of a worm, but let's parse through it. Talleyrand's theorem is a theorem about products of measure spaces, which can seem a little bit more abstract than what we're used to thinking about, but it's very concrete. We've been looking at points on the square, but that's not the product that's interesting. The product that's interesting is that when we take a sample of size n, we've got, because of the independence, we have that product space. So it's the product of our successive samples. So in the cases that we've been looking at, you could think of omega as 0, 1 squared. So omega to the n could be identified with 0, 1 to the 2n. Now, there exists a distance which you can think of as being quite similar to the Hamming distance, but it's a Hamming distance that lets us add weights. And it actually lets us add weights at a fortuitous time for ourselves, as we'll see in examples. So let me just lay it out. The distance from a point to a set So I have a point, X, and I have a set A. And I'm interested in the distance from that point to that set. And what that does, it says, consider all of the weights for any set of weights. I can find some y, depending upon those weights, such that if I look at the number of places, I look at the places where xi differs from yi, and I weight those up, then those are less than t. Now, my condition on the weights is that my weights, some of the weights, should be less than 1 in little l2. Now, a way to write that in a way that's actually convenient for the applications that we'd make, and a way which keeps me from having to impose yet another condition on this worm, is to say that the distance is equal to the minimum t, such that this weight of the discordances is bounded by t. Okay? Now, that's a little bit strange, and we're going to see some more on this. Another way of saying the same thing is that this distance is the largest value of z sub alpha, that is, we get to pick the worst weights. So z sub alpha is equal to the closest value over A of the weights, and the weights depending upon x, times the discordances. And here I went ahead and imposed the condition that the sum of the weights squared is bounded by 1. Okay? Kind of hard to be absolutely sure that you've written down your quantifiers in the right order, and it's interesting that it is possible in this theory to manage to write them down in the wrong order. So I want to keep an eye out for that. Now, the phrasing of Talleyrand's theorem and the phrasing is set up to assist us in the nature of the proof, which is going to be a proof by induction, is that the quadratic version of what we could think of as kind of a moment-generating function, that is, this exponential integral, is bounded by 1 over the measure of A. Now, what that tells us in a way that's useful is that the probability that this distance is bigger than t is bounded by a Gaussian tail divided by P of A. So if P of A is a tiny set, this estimate might not be useful. But for a set, typically we apply this where A is the set where our random variable is less than its median. So for us, very commonly, P of A is equal to a half. Okay, that's a sort of our generic setup would be where P of A is equal to a half. And so for such an A, it says the probability that this distance being larger than T has a Gaussian tail bound. So the probability that we're more than 8 standard deviations is going to be quite small. Now, another way of saying that same thing is if we take the set A and we fatten it up by adding in all of those points which are within this Talleyrand distance of A, then we have a set which is almost a full set. That is, it's equal to 1 minus an amount which is Gaussianly small. Okay, now, pretty abstract object, but one which, with a little practice, adds very powerfully to the theory of bounded differences. By the way, I got a few truly poetic phrases in this write-up. No one's come up to me and said, God, that's a beautiful phrase, so I thought I'd mention a few of them to you. One of them begins this chapter, a central motivation for our study of Talleyrand's isoperimetric theory is that in virtually every case where the bounded difference method can be applied, Talleyrand's methods do at least as well, and in many instances, they do dramatically better. Okay? Now, doesn't that have sort of a ring of poetry to it? Here's another one of which I'm particularly proud.
I don't know. It seems to me more like a threat. Learn this or you're out in the cold.
There's a piece of that that's true. And the sense is, a way of saying that, there are lots of problems on which you could work really hard where a guy that knows this inequality could walk in and get a faster result in an afternoon than you got in months. So there are changes in technology that one just has to keep up with, and I think this is one of them. But returning to the poetry, there in section 7 of lecture 5. Perhaps the most persistent source of bedevilment in applied probability is the approximate independence that one can see but cannot hold. Rhapsodic. Thanks. Yeah, that's the thing, because you know, if you have engineers as friends as I do, and they're happy to look at something and see that it's approximately independent and say, well, it's just, you know, it's approximately independent, let's suppose it's independent, then, you know, it just brings tears to the eyes to the guy who has to work months to handle some form of approximate independence. Okay, so let's look at an example of the Talleyrand's theorem as applied to the longest increasing subsequence. So, generically, we let A of little a be the set of y such that the length of the longest increasing subsequence associated with y is bounded by A. Now, one of the things that makes this useful and shows you sort of how you bring this distance into the types of combinatorial problems you're interested in is given by the next inequality. If we let J be the set that realizes the increasing and increasing subsequence of maximal length for X, then we see the length of the longest increasing subsequence for Y is at least as large as the length of the longest increasing subsequence for X minus the number of places where Y disagrees with X, and in particular where Y disagrees with X on that set which was the largest increasing subsequence. So not only have we been able to reduce it to a Hamming-like issue, we've been able to reduce it to a Hamming-like issue where we focused entirely upon just what was the interesting part of X. That's one of the keys to applying Talleyrand's inequality, is that this ability to choose the A's lets you focus your bounded difference weights on the place that's interesting and important for your problem. Okay. All right, well, the top inequality, if we now look over the minimum overall y, just tells us that if we take the minimum overall y of the set of discordances in J, well, that's certainly equal to, if we divide by, if J has cardinality K, if I multiply by 1 on K and multiply by the square root of K, I've now got something in here where these are weights that have L2 bound of 1. So this quantity is no larger than, well, I've got the square root of K, and then by definition, this object is something that's bounded above by Talleyrand's distance, d sub t. Talleyrand couldn't call it, in all due humility, couldn't call his distance d sub t, but we can call it d sub t, and I think that we properly should. Okay. Now, by the choice of y, we know that I of y is less than a, so we have the inequality that a is bigger than I in x. Remember, this was by definition equal to k, so this is the square root of I in x, and then we had Talleyrand's distance. So now, that tells us that the length of the longest increasing subsequence being larger than the a that we began with, plus a little bit, is bounded above by the probability that Talleyrand's distance exceeds that amount. Okay, that's just from arithmetic of the previous line. This is something you hit immediately with Talleyrand, and you get 1 over p of a x minus u squared onto 4a plus u. Okay, now, that's just a one-sided bound. A similar piece of reasoning gives you a bound on the other side, and you can combine these two bounds, and when you do, you end up with concentration inequalities that show that that I is concentrated in an interval which only has width on the order of into the 1/4. Whereas before, using if we use just a zoom all by itself, we only got concentration in an interval of size big O of the square root of n, and that was trivial. By Fries's subtle method and a lot of hard work, we were able to squeeze that down to big O of n to the 1/3. And here, in one reasonably automatic but patient page, you were able to bust that down all the way to concentration and interval of size order into the 1/4. Yeah, Howard.
Why isoperimetric?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. Why isoperimetric? The traditional isoperimetric theorem, circa 1900, says that if you begin with a piece of string of length L, then the largest area that you could enclose with that is an area which is given by a circle. That's the traditional isoperimetric inequality. Okay. Now, a way of thinking about such things and proving such things is you take a set, say B, and you fatten it up by adding everything that's within an epsilon ball of that, for instance, by Minkowski addition of a ball of radius epsilon. And then the issue becomes the comparison of B epsilon versus B. We know that B epsilon is larger than B. Okay, so it evolved that the isoperimetric inequality became not the study of the relationship between boundaries and contents, but the relationship between the volumes of fattened sets and sets. And in fact, if you just look at what the Brun-Minkowski inequality gives you for B and B plus an epsilon ball and let epsilon shrink, you recover, in the planar case, exactly the isoperimetric theorem of Steiner and others. Okay, so it's just part of the evolution of the subject where now we would call anything that studies the fattened ball. It's a nice middle-aged way of thinking about these things as isoperimetric theory. Okay? I hope that was satisfactory. Okay. Well, let's look at some of the tools of the proof, beginning the proof of the isoperimetric inequality. And we begin, there are several characterizations of DT. And that's one of the nice things. You've got a good object often if there are several different ways of looking at that same object. And we can give a dual characterization, which is quite handy. Let's look at a more elementary question for a second. Suppose that you just wanted to understand the relationship of a vector to a set. Now, one of the things you could do is, for each element of that set, look at that point on the D cube which were discordant. That is, look at the vector of discordances. So if I have any x and any y, which are elements of the product space, I can form a vector of discordances. And if I looked at the union of that set over all y's, that would be a nice geometric object to help me understand the relationship of a fixed value vector x to a whole set of values y, the set of discordances. Now, the set of discordances doesn't have as nice a combinatorial structure as you like, and one of the tricks that people have learned over time to make things nice and monotone is to throw in some extra points. And in particular, if you want to make the set of discordances an upset, that is a set where supersets are contained, then you'd have to add in some additional points. So initially, we start out with the n cube. We circle all of the vertices of the n cube, which correspond to a discordant vector for a point and an element of the set. We then throw in all of the points that are needed in order to give myself an upset, or a set that is contained under addition of additional units. And what I'm left with at that point is a set that, well, if that set doesn't contain the, if the set contains the origin, then that means that X is in A. Okay, because that would mean that there was a Y for which there was no discordances. So if X is not in A, there exists some distance between the origin and the convex hull of this fattened set of discordant points. Okay. That distance is exactly the distance that I wrote down before. Okay. Turns out, just to be pure geometry, to show that that distance is exactly the same as the other two ways as I wrote that distance. Okay. Now this is nice because it brings in some convex geometry for us. Okay. Then the proof of that is written out. So I know some people had kind of glazed over eyes there. Now that's the proposition. It says dual characterization of D sub T on page 4, and it requires a little thought, but it's really fewer than 10 lines there on page 5. Okay. All right, now here, following the rule, Spitzer, who was my hero, told me that if you understand the subject, you can write it on one page. And there, by that rule, it's a pretty tough rule. You might be able to understand the page. The issue is whether anybody else could understand the page. But here's an attempt to write that the proof of Talleyrand's theorem reasonably completely and on one page. And we'll look at the pieces of it, and by looking at the notes, I think that you can add any details that might be missing. Okay. So let's consider a set A, and this is the A that features into the statement of the theorem. So we want to prove a theorem of the form that some integral is bounded by a simple function of the measure of A. Okay. The plan for doing this is to use induction. Okay. Checking this for sets which are single dimensioned is just an immediate calculus check. Okay. So you can get started. And now the issue is, how do you do an induction on this integral? Well, there are a couple of pieces to it. One is to look at sections, and the other is to look at projections. Up here, I've drawn omega n plus 1, the product space omega n plus 1, that next dimension that we're going to act inductively on, as a product of omega down here, and this is omega to the n, and omega up here, which is one product space dimensional. Now I pick an element in omega and I look at the section. And can everybody read that? Am I in the way? I don't see how people do that. Do they get blinded if they do that? I now see nothing but green dots. You should never look into those things. We may have to make a phone call to worker disability here. Okay, so that's the section. Now, omega, A omega up there, is really a subset that lives in omega n. I've drawn it up there as if it was living in omega n plus 1. So this is really the set that would consist of all omega, aw, comma. So I've drawn it up there as if it lived in A n plus 1. But it's a one-dimensional set. Now, also, I've got the projection, which is easy to see here, and which we could write out analytically. No juggling intended. I write it out analytically as the set of all of the x's in omega n, such that I've got these in the wrong order. Capital omega, comma, x is contained in A. Okay. Now, we've got a set, we've got two lower dimensional sets, and we've got a distance. And we're in a Portuguese prison cell. Very shortly, you find a relationship between those things. Okay. And it turns out that the relationship, the distance from Z to A squared, is, well, it's sort of a convex combination of the distances to the two pieces, of the distances to the section and the distance to the projection. But when we use the distance to the section, there's really just the one piece to it. But when we use the distance to the projection, we sort of lose in one coordinate. Okay, and that sounds vague as I've said it, but the reason that we've picked up an extra term here is because when we have to make this comparison, we're really having to take the worst loss that we can in one coordinate. Okay, now that's infallible in that way I've said that, but if you read the notes, and I hope you will, you'll be able to check that that's a true assertion. And nevertheless, the assertion certainly is that if you were in the prison and thought for a little while about this geometry and that distance, you would verify that relationship. Okay, now, but what good is that relationship? What I'm trying to do so far is the proof of Talleyrand's theorem really is automatic. The formulation of Talleyrand's theorem is far from automatic. And what you had to have done was run through a jillion different possible proofs 1,000 times before you came up with a good formulation. So there's a lot of brilliant energy that went into that formulation. But once you've got the formulation, both of the distance and the proof by induction, then it's just patience and a little bit of work. All right, so what's the first part of the patience? Well, we've chosen an omega. We fixed an omega. So if I write down the n-dimensional integral with omega fixed, we have something such that if I just integrated this over omega, I would have the n plus 1-dimensional integral that I was interested in to complete my induction. Okay. Well, anybody in the world who has this relationship and that exponential will take this relationship and plug it into that exponential. And anybody in the world will then pull out this part that doesn't depend upon omega. And then anybody in the world who's just written down something that's manifestly a product of two things will apply Hurlder's inequality. And you get this. Okay. Now, you say, all right, I've done the most automatic thing, and oh, God, I ought to pick my lambda. Oh, I hate that. So, you know, you sit and squirm for a while, and, you know, you don't want to do it, and you put it off for a couple of days, and then finally you sit down and do the little piece of calculus that corresponds to finding upper bounds on this sum, applying the induction hypothesis in the two places that you can apply the induction hypothesis. So you apply the induction hypothesis, and now you choose your best lambda. Or if not your best lambda, then a good lambda. Okay? I would say that 10% of us, the lucky 10%, would be out in a day. Most folks would be out in 2 days. Few folks would maybe take a week. Some poor soul in this room might actually languish in there for months, but basically everybody would eventually get out. Okay? So you end up by, this step's just by Hurlder, this is by induction. This is by induction, and now this is just by picking your appropriate lambda. So this is just by calculus. Okay, so this was actually the tedious bit, but a completely doable bit. And now, just integrate that. When you integrate this, you've got 1 on B, 2 minus. Now, when you integrate this top guy, you get P of A. And then you've got a commodity that seems to have an A and a B in it, but I didn't write down this little piece because it didn't fit on the foil. But if you use just a tiny little inequality, and I hope I wrote it down here. Yeah, you use the tiniest little inequality that says that x times 2 minus x is less than 1 for all real x. Okay? So in here I've got 1 on P of A, 2 minus, I've got P of A over P of B. Okay, now, what I do is, here I've got P of A over P of B. I write this as 1 over P of A divided by P of B. Then let me write that term in there. So to make things fair, I add this term and that term. This guy's an X, that guy's an X, and X times 2X, 2 minus X is bounded by 1. Dunsky. I mean, there are places one could get lost, but with the plan, the theorem really is pretty easy.
There's no penalty at the prison for typos.
No, fortunately not, no. No, they just check your proof and say, it contains an error, return to your cell. And then eventually you fix the typo. You found some in here? You can tell me about those later. Okay, so that's the proof in a nutshell. Any questions or puzzles about that? Now, you can see how a plan of that generality would have lots of variations. Twiddle this notion of distance a little bit and ask yourself, can I walk through this plan again? And it's very easy except for the calculus bit, and it's very easy except for knowing how to formulate those inequalities that are going to be of most use for you. Another thing one can do is, with the problem at hand, see, you don't. This is written in a way to be modular, but there are a lot of problems out there where you don't have to use the off-the-shelf module. You can say, look, I've got this problem. I'm going to set it up by an induction, use a plan analogous to this, and see what it gives me in my problem. Okay? I don't know of any successes that have yet come forth doing that in this exact case, but that's certainly one of the things at our disposal. Okay. So it's easy. It's powerful. For instance, I won't do it today, but next time I will show you how to get the Gaussian tail for the TSP using this very easily. Use a little piece of space-filling curve theory, use Talleyrand's inequality, and you get the Gaussian tail bound on the TSP. And that was something which was proved earlier by Rhee and Talleyrand via a real tour de force. I mean, they had a couple of papers on that. I had a paper on that. Everybody made a little contribution to this. But then they smashed the real theorem by a very hard technique, and yet even that's handled nicely by this method. Okay. Also, Talleyrand's theorem gives you some interesting elementary inequalities that come in special forms that you don't get by the more traditional devices. And here's one has a kind of elegant symmetry. It's not very useful, but it also has an elegant symmetry that I like. So take a bunch of random variables. And, you know, the temptation would be to say take random variables that are bounded or take random variables that are between 0 and 1. But for an application that we'll make later on, it's useful to take random variables xi such that xi is between ri and ri plus 1. But that's a small difference. A very fundamental functional is to take z, which is the supremum, over all linear combinations where the linear combinations are chosen from a specified set. Okay, so it might be if you want to have the sum over all k subblocks, suppose you were studying something like the sums of random variables, but what you were interested in was the largest value over a sum of k successive values, then that would just be the functional that would start at j, j plus 1, j plus 2, on up to j plus k minus 1. Now, if you take the supremum over all elements of your family, just to measure the size of your family, then we have this inequality, which is kind of interesting. I don't know of any other probability inequalities that have this shape, but it's an interesting shape. It says the probability of... It doesn't matter by symmetry which one I make A, but... The probability that either bigger, the product of being bigger than A, bigger than B or smaller than A is bounded by no constant here, x, squared difference between the two values, and 4t squared, measuring this kind of an elegant form. Okay. By choosing special values, for instance, suppose we choose A equal to m, just to build your intuition, suppose we take A equal to m, the median, and B equal to m plus u. If B is equal to m plus u and A is equal to m, then this just becomes u squared. So this would say that the probability of being more than u bigger than the median is bounded by 2x minus u squared 4 on tau squared. So this is an inequality which converts back to the more familiar type of inequalities quite automatically. Okay. Now let's look at a proof for this. And in this case, just sit down and think about it for a second. Then, by the definition of Talleyrand's distance, the distance from x to a, it's always at least as big as the, as close as you can get to. Now I can pick it, put any weights here I want, but I just pick weights that are given by my by the alpha I. Yeah, that's true. That's certainly true. This is true for all choices of alpha I. Nothing to that. Okay. So, in particular, if I take any, there exists some y which is an a. So this sum for any alpha I is bounded by. Now this will be the supremum over all the alpha I. So from this relationship, I would get this value, where I have the supremum over all of the alpha i's. There I've just moved the supremum, this guy to the other side, move this guy to that side, and then take the supremum. Okay? All right. Now I bring in the a and do a little piece of arithmetic, and I get the object that I was interested in. I can now take the supremum there if I wanted to. Take the supremum on that side, and then I get z of y. So if I sup this, I get z of x. So z of x is bounded above by a plus tau, Talleyrand's distance. Well, then just applying Talleyrand with this is the a set. That says the probability that the deviation is bigger than B is bounded by 1 over P of A, exp, the difference, divided by that guy. Okay. So this is just the 4 tau numerized difference. Okay. All right. So that's pretty automatic. Pretty automatic. Okay. There's always a little fiddling. You always have to sort of go back to the definition of Talleyrand's distance. You have to look at the problem you're interested in, and you have to relate that to a given set. But other than that, it's a pretty automatic procedure. Now let me give you, did I bring any? Yeah. A set of functionals looks kind of abstract, but the object is not that abstract, really. And let's look at one that we've already seen before. For instance, let's look at that. Let's make that C. Cij, Cij uniform on 0, 1 squared, and Aij, and if Aij let's look at the assignment problem. So if A is equal to, if P is equal to the set of permutation matrices, and I take the infimum over all A and P, then this object is just exactly equal to what we called the assignment problem, the value of the assignment problem. It's the cheapest assignment. But that's the same thing as the supremum over all A and P of IJ, CIJ, minus CIJ. So for a set of independent random variables, that's exactly of the form. So a concentration result of the form that we just gave for suprema is directly applicable to the assignment problem. Okay? Now, if you make that application to the assignment problem, you don't quite get the most useful result in the world. What you do get is kind of bad because the sizes of the CIJs which are used are too big. But we know in our heart of hearts that we don't really have to use any CIJs that are much bigger than the square root of log n on n. So that requires a subsidiary argument, but with that subsidiary argument, we can drastically reduce the size of the CIs that we consider. Okay, and that subsidiary argument's got some fun pieces to it, but I'll let you read those in the notes. Okay, and the bottom line out of that subsidiary argument and Talleyrand's inequality is that we get, now these aren't beautiful, but they are, and they're probably not sharp, but they're sort of the natural limit to the method without adding additional ideas. And they tell us that the deviations of the assignment problem from its median has a small bound in comparison to these quantities. And if you think through those quantities, I've forgotten exactly what the nature of the concentration that gives you, but I think it's on the order of square root log n on n. Okay. I'd have to check the notes to remind myself what concentration that gives you. But the interesting thing is, think where we are in the history of this. There was no information about the variance of AN prior to Talleyrand's inequality. And Talleyrand's inequality, applied in a pretty automatic way, not only gives you enough information to give you good control over the variance, enough to say give you any form of strong law that you like, but gives you pretty sharp tail bounds pretty automatically. We don't really know what the right size of those tail bounds should be, but they're pretty close. Okay. Now, little word about the traveling salesman problem. Maybe we'll be able to do this now. Same technology applied to the traveling salesman problem in D equal to 2 is going to be good enough to show that the length minus the expected value bigger than T has Gaussian quality bound. Remember before I sketched for you a way using Birkholder's square function and Birkholder's inequality that we had e to the minus t squared on log t. So this really sort of finishes it off. It gives us the right level for this theorem. Okay.
So, Mike?
Yeah.
Is there a similar bound for the other Euclidean functionals like MST and minimal matching?
Yes. Yes.
Just using Talleyrand's.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I can't swear about minimal matching, but MST works.
There's no
constant by square dimension. In here, no. Because you remember that if you have 200 billion points in the unit square, the variance of the TSP tour is bounded by 2. Okay, and variance of the TSP is bounded independently of n. So there's no normalization there. It comes born centered.
Okay.
It's like a real California guy. Okay. All right, so let's think about how you'd prove that. Well, DTXA is equal to, well, what's our choice for A? Well, the logical A is going to be equal to all of the places where that's less than the median, or A where T is bigger than the median. Okay, those are going to be our candidates for A. Those are our generic candidates for A. Now, let's think about an upper bound on Talleyrand's distance. An upper bound on Talleyrand's distance is the sum from I equal 1 to N of alpha X, alpha I, X, indicator YI not equal to XI, and there I get to take the min over all Y, which is contained in A. Okay, that's just the definition of Talleyrand's distance. Okay, so what's the art? The art is, how do you choose the alpha i's? Okay. Well, what you want to do is you want to give weight to those guys. You have to think about, you know, you'd know that this would be one way or the other, and you'd have to think through it both ways before you decided which. But after you did that, you decided that you want to give more weight to those guys that required long edges. So somehow you want to give more weight to the holes. Okay, now, Talleyrand had an elegant way of a hard way of doing this, but one which really got to the essence of the matter and understood that the essential thing was to measure the size of the hole. And the benefit of getting the second shot at it is that you get to use a trickery in place of hard work. So if we wanted to measure sort of how isolated a point was, and we wanted to use a little piece of trickery, one thing might be to say, let's take the heuristic tour through these given by the space-filling curve heuristic. And now, what would be a suitable choice of alpha? Well, up there we need alphas. Let's let alpha I of X, let's put a hat on that first, equal to the sum of the edges incident to XI in the space-filling curve heuristic tour. So if that's XI, and that's an edge, and that's an edge, E plus E primed is a way of measuring that. So that's a way of measuring sort of how much trouble this point is in a space-filling curve. Now you remember that for the space-filling curve heuristic that we had that the sum of the edges squared was bounded by a constant. Yeah. Thank you. I go on to N. We had it bounded by a constant. So I can't quite do that, but if I do that times 1 on the square root of C for some value of C, then that gives me some alpha I's whose sums of squares is bounded by 1. Okay? Now, we're done. Talleyrand's theorem for this choice, 2 microseconds of thought, complete. Yep. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Talleyrand's distance is the supremum over all choices of that alpha. So when I pick my alpha, I get a guy which is bigger than. Thanks. Right, and we want to show that. I want to show that the probability. Let's make sure we don't lie. Well, it's right as written there. Okay. Now, one piece of that is how do you relate the tours, and that requires a little bit of tying them together. And I'll show you how there's a little detail on tying them together, but we can do that next time. It'll probably make a good exercise for you to finish this fellow off as it stands anyway. So that's what we have for today. Thanks.